I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
Radio Times. Should American farms grow food or fuel? That's a question that's being asked as more and more corn growers are producing ethanol. Supporters argue that this fuel comes from a domestically grown renewable energy source and does not have the harmful environmental effects that come from fossil fuel emissions. Critics question the benefits, saying that it takes too much energy to produce ethanol, and since it has to be trucked, it actually adds to CO2 emissions. President Bush has called for an increase in ethanol production to 35 billion gallons a year by 2017. He's not the only one touting the benefits of ethanol. A number of presidential candidates are supporting the idea, as well as members of Congress. Today on Radio Times, would increasing the amount of ethanol have a positive effect on the environment? Would it actually reduce the country's dependence on foreign oil? And how would it affect the economy? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We have two guests who have joined us by telephone. Tom Slunecka is Executive Director of the Ethanol Promotion and Information Council. That's a nonprofit alliance of ethanol industry leaders. And Tom Slunecka, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Marty. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you here. Robert Bryce is an energy journalist, managing editor for the Energy Tribune, and he's the author of a book coming out next year called Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. Robert Bryce, nice to have you with us as well. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Tom, if I could begin with you, just because I want to make sure our listeners know exactly what we're talking about. Describe what ethanol is and where it comes from.
Okay, well, ethanol, of course, is produced all across the country. It's a product that's been in existence for hundreds of years. And today in the United States, we're producing over 6 billion gallons of this product from starch-based grains. Now, that can include corn, sorghum, wheat, barley, any of those types of grains. And it's produced here in the United States from starch-based grains primarily because those are the grains that are the most abundant. Those crops are indigenous here to the United States. Now, of course, in South America, where they can raise sugar cane, they can actually produce ethanol from sugar. Basically, what we do is we take starch, we break it down into sugar, and then we ferment sugar into alcohol, and that is the basis of the product.
And most of that comes from corn, yes?
Here in the United States, most of it does come from corn, yes.
Let me get a response. Robert Bryce, anything you want to add to that?
Well, as we go along, of course, but I think the first thing is, listeners should realize that the ethanol producers always talk about billions of gallons. What the consumption, though, in the U.S. is measured in millions of barrels. So, yes, in 2006, the ethanol producers produced about 5 billion gallons of oil, or 5 billion gallons of ethanol, but that's only about 215,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day, which is about 1% of America's total oil consumption. And those are the critical metrics. How does the ethanol convert into oil equivalent? And that's the key metric to keep in mind as you hear the ethanol producers talk about billions of gallons. It's not about gallons. It's about millions of barrels.
Well, go ahead, Tom.
It doesn't matter how we measure it. That people do not buy barrels of oil. They buy gallons of product, and that's why the ethanol industry has put its language around gallons, because that's what the consumers actually purchase.
And how many gallons in a barrel?
42 gallons are in a barrel.
Okay, just so we're all using the same metrics here. Let me go back to you, Tom. Let's take a bushel of corn. How many gallons of ethanol can you get from a bushel of corn?
Well, when we started the process here about 5 years ago, whenever we really started to ramp up, it was about 2.3, but now most of the ethanol plants are producing over 3 gallons of ethanol per bushel of corn.
And how much of the corn production in this country today is being used for ethanol?
It's about 25% will go into ethanol. And, of course, one of the co-products that comes out of that is distiller's grains that remain in our feed market, in our food market, just as it always did.
And what's the goal? I mean, how much ethanol do you think this country can produce, and how much corn production would that take?
Well, we believe that with the increases in productivity of corn that we're seeing today, that we should reach about 10% of the U.S. Gasoline could come from corn-based or starch-based ethanol. And then to reach beyond that, we'll need to go into cellulosic feedstocks.
And I'll get to that. Robert Bryce, what's your complaint?
Well, I think, I mean, the biggest one here is that this production of ethanol and the ethanol producers, it's all about maintaining the subsidies. This is fiscal insanity. We are making subsidized motor fuel out of the single most subsidized crop in America, and that is corn. Corn ethanol producers, in 2005 alone, corn subsidies totaled $9.4 billion. That's approximately equal to the entire 2006 budget for the Department of Commerce. That's the federal agency that has 39,000 employees. Corn subsidies dwarf every other agricultural subsidy program in America. Between 1995 and 2005, corn subsidies totaled $51.2 billion. That's twice as much subsidies as were spent on wheat, twice as much as the amount spent on cotton, four times as much as it was spent on soybeans, and 96 times more than was spent on tobacco. I mean, this is all about the subsidy machine. And, you know, Mr. Slonecka can talk about, you know, what, energy security, can talk about foreign oil, all he wants. But the point is, this is all about maintaining subsidies for this one industry, and they cannot exist without massive federal subsidies. That's the story.
Well, and let me give Tom Slonecka a chance to respond to that, and I also want to break it down even further than that. But go ahead, Tom. Respond to the subsidy argument.
Well, of course, subsidies are in place to keep food prices down, and the United States has the lowest cost of food in the world, and that comes from subsidies. Now, the subsidy rate in the United States is far less than that of Europe. What Mr. Bryce is not telling you is that because of corn ethanol and because of what it has done for the economic impact of this country, we actually reduced our subsidies by $8 billion last year, and that could not have happened. The subsidies that he talked about would have likely have been paid regardless, but we were able to reduce those subsidies because of ethanol in this country. But I would actually like to pose it back as a question.
Okay.
What is the largest subsidy recipient in this country today? Big oil.
Well, Robert Bryce?
It dwarfs all agriculture subsidies by well over 40%.
Go ahead, Robert Bryce.
Well, can you give me some data? Is there a source for this? What's the number? I mean, you know, you can throw that out there, but, you know, here I can give you the numbers and the citations in terms of what ethanol has done for the average American. You can talk about big oil all you want. Everybody likes to bash big oil. That's fine. I'm happy to do it as well. But what has been the result for consumers of the new ethanol, the boom in the ethanol business? There was a study released last May by the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development at Iowa State University, Iowa being, remember, the biggest ethanol producer in the country. What the results of this report showed that, what ethanol has done is create essentially a new food tax on every consumer in America. So the idea that somehow ethanol benefits consumers is flat wrong. Given the data that this came out of Iowa State, they estimate, if you take their data and you calculate it on equivalent amounts of gasoline, every gallon of ethanol, the equivalent food tax is equal to $3.72 for every gallon of gasoline displaced by ethanol. The number that the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development came up with is that between July 2006 and May of 2007, the food bill for every American increased by $47 due to increased grain prices because of the ethanol scam. And they put it, the total cost, this is the quote from the report, the total cost of ethanol to consumers is about $14 billion. You divide 5 billion gallons of ethanol into that. Every gallon of ethanol produced in this country costs taxpayers, in the form of a new food tax, about $3.
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I tell you what, I would like you to ask that opinion of the 160,000 new jobs that were created in the ethanol industry, the $6.7 billion that have been added to our economy because of this product. Would you prefer that we sent those dollars overseas, you know, to the same countries that are doing massive destruction across the world for human rights as well as terrorism? Is ethanol perfect? No. But what is your solution? What would you prefer that we do?
Go ahead, Robert Bryce.
Well, look, you know, you can talk, this is, again, this is the same argument that is used by the farm lobby uses it, the neoconservatives use it, unfortunately a lot of these presidential candidates are using it, which is conflating the idea that oil equals terrorism, that if only we bought less oil from the Middle East, magically terrorism will disappear.
Well, this
just is flat not the case. I mean, the numbers, it is a global market in energy, and this somehow the ethanol producers think that we can isolate ourselves from the global market. The numbers just don't show that. In 2005, the U.S. bought crude oil from 41 countries, we bought gasoline from 46 countries, and jet fuel from 26 others. It's a global market. Whether Mr. Seleneca likes it or not, whether the ethanol producers or the neoconservatives, the fact is it's an integrated global energy market, and nothing that the, no matter how much ethanol we produce, is going to change that fact.
Well, let me ask a couple of questions here to you, Robert Bryce.
Sure.
But are you saying that, and the U.S. uses something like 21 million barrels of oil a day?
Correct.
Should we reduce our use of oil? Or is that a sustainable amount of oil?
Well, it's a huge amount of oil by any measure. Okay, there's no question.
Right.
But understand that that is what makes the American economy so vibrant. Energy consumption equals economic development. It's true. There's no question about that. But the idea that somehow American farmers can grow ourselves out of our energy patterns or anything else is a hoax of the worst kind.
Hold on.
Even if you convert all the corn grown in America, 10.5 billion bushels last year, and convert it into ethanol, it would only equal 6% of America's total oil needs.
But are you saying that that the U.S. should continue as it does today, importing 21 million barrels of oil a day? Doesn't it make sense to have a diverse source of energy? Yes, maybe ethanol can play a role, solar can play a role, wind can play a role, oil can play a role?
Well, look, we don't import 21 million barrels a day. We import about 12 million barrels a day. Of those imports, only 11% come from the Persian Gulf.
But we're
our biggest suppliers are Canada and Mexico.
But we're talking about, though, a finite energy source, are we
of
not?
Of course,
talking
and
about
there's
oil?
A finite amount of corn that can be grown and a finite amount of solar energy that we can capture and a finite amount of wind that we can capture. Yes,
energy
is
exactly
a hard business.
To our point.
Well, okay, go ahead, Tom.
That's exactly to our point. You know, I read the article that Mr. Bryce put out on August 21st. I found it on the web, and it's fine. It's great to tear down a new industry. You know, it's great to use subsidies as your crutch as to why this needs to be done. But you offer no solutions. You have not embraced the fact that we need to do something. Is this system exactly perfect? No. And again, you continue to say, you know, neoconservatism. Well, if you look, both sides of the aisle have supported renewable fuels. Both sides of the aisle continue to promote more and more renewable fuels to be built. The infrastructure needs to be built today. Now, is the infrastructure being subsidized to some degree? Absolutely. Was the infrastructure subsidized for oil? Absolutely, 100%. Is it still subsidized today? Yes, and you know it is. So the question is why are you so adamant against this product as a new start, as something new for this country, as a new way for the next generation to try a different route?
Well,
are we really desiccating the American consumer by adding a few cents to the price of a pork chop?
Well, I highly doubt
it.
We'll get that answer after the short break. That's Tom Sunica, Executive Director of the Ethanol Promotion and Information Council. Also with us, Robert Bryce. He's an energy journalist, managing editor of the Energy Tribune. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Focus Features, presenting the new espionage film Lust, Caution, from Ang Lee, the Academy Award-winning director of Brokeback Mountain. Lust, Caution, now in select theaters.
The Executive MBA program at Temple University's Fox School of Business proudly supports WHYY. On Friday, October 19th, and Saturday, October 20th, the Fox Executive MBA program, delivered at the Desmond Conference Center in Malvern, PA, is hosting information sessions. It's an opportunity to meet faculty and staff, to experience the Fox Executive MBA curriculum, and to have your questions answered by current students over lunch. Registration online at fox.temple.edu.
I'm Marty Moscowane, inviting you to be in the audience when Radio Times visits Princeton University on Wednesday, October 24th at 6 p.m. We'll tape a program looking at the state of national politics, and you'll have a chance to ask some of the questions. To reserve your seat for this exclusive WHYY member event, call 215-351-0511 or visit whyy.org. If you're not already a member, you can join today. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Germantown Friends School, authentic Quaker education for boys and girls K-12. Hosting an open house this Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. For details or to RSVP, www.germantownfriends.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. So would increasing the amount of ethanol have a positive effect on the environment? Would it reduce the country's dependence on foreign oil? Would it affect the U.S. economy? We're getting two perspectives, one from Robert Bryce, he's an energy journalist, managing editor of the Energy Tribune, and Tom Slunica, executive director of the Ethanol Promotion and Information Council. That's a nonprofit alliance of ethanol industry leaders. And I do want to open the phones at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I want to raise a whole bunch of other questions about ethanol, but Robert Bryce, I want to get you to answer Tom Slunica's question about if not ethanol, then what?
Well, I think that then what is, one, we need to be using more natural gas. This is a clean-burning fuel. It is far cleaner than burning ethanol, which, you know, I hope we can get to this later in terms of what ethanol does to air quality, because the EPA's own numbers show that using more ethanol will worsen air quality in many cities and states across the country. The other fact is we just have to accept the fact that it is a global market. It's a global market in iPods, fresh flowers. It's a global market in gasoline, crude oil. And it's not just about crude oil and gasoline. The U.S. imports 80%, more than 80% of the uranium needed to fuel its nuclear reactors. We import coal. We import electricity from Mexico and Canada. The energy market is integrated, and the idea that, oh, well, we have to panic and therefore we need to, you know, give big subsidies to farmers in order to provide what relatively minuscule amounts of motor fuel to the market is just crazy. We just have to face the facts that the economy is integrated and deal with it and move on.
But you're saying natural gas is the solution?
No, I'm not saying it's the solution. It is one of the solutions. We need to produce more oil domestically. We need to open the Eastern Gulf of Mexico. We need to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We need to develop the domestic resources that we have, in addition to accepting the fact that the global market is integrated, and that integration is going to continue. It's getting more integrated every day.
The idea that we can secede from the
global market if only we grew more corn is crazy. Let me give you another fact.
No, you know what, Marty, Robert, hold on one second. Let me give Tom Slunica a chance to respond. Go ahead, Tom.
I'm sorry. In all of Mrs. Bryce's explanation, I heard nothing but oil, oil, oil. I might have to look at your portfolio to find out how much Exxon stock you own. You haven't mentioned solar. How possibly could you be so irate about something that we agree will be a small part of the solution? And to your comment about farm subsidies, do you think that if we stop producing ethanol that we'll no longer subsidize agriculture? That's crazy. We've already reduced the subsidies by corn farmers because of ethanol has made them more profitable. And the only reason that we're subsidizing producers today is just keep pace with the European Union. Now, yes, of course it's a global market. We know that. We've been exporting corn from this country for over 150 years. We know how to export. We know how to import. But there is no solution. There is no alternative in your explanation.
Well, Tom, let me ask you a couple of questions, and this has to do with the production of corn for ethanol. One of the questions raised about that is the amount of water that's needed, the amount of pesticides, fertilizers that's used, the fact that ethanol has to be trucked or sent by train because it can't go through a pipeline, that all these costs factor into what it actually, the kind of benefit, energy benefit that the U.S. gets from ethanol, and the critics say there isn't much benefit there.
Yeah, you know, agriculture has proven in this country to it has been and continues to be one of the backbones of this country. When we look at corn production in the 1950s, when our hybridization of corn occurred, we were producing about 47 bushel per acre. Now the national average is well over 170 bushel an acre, and all of the major seed companies today predict that within 10 to 15 years we'll see 300 bushel per acre. Now there's no manufacturing process in this country today that can show that type of growth and efficiencies in their process. Now, the corn that was produced, we actually produced more corn in the 1930s than we did today, but the amount of corn that was collected was less than a third of what we collect today. Our efficiencies are running at a scale that no one can keep up with. We use the exact same amount of water, in fact, less water than we did in the early 80s to produce 20% more corn today. That's because of technology and irrigation has advanced. We're now using drip irrigation as opposed to flood irrigation. When it comes to pesticides, we've reduced the amount of pesticides by several hundred million pounds annually because of the use of biotechnology as well as better farm practices.
Well, let me quote
every year it gets better and better.
Let me quote a David Pimentel from Cornell University, and he's a critic of ethanol. He is quoted as saying that ethanol requires 29% more energy from fossil fuels than it delivers in savings from not using gasoline.
That's true. Mr. Pimentel is actually one of only two researchers in the entire country that have numbers that look like this. All of the research that has been done by the U.S. government has proven that actually ethanol has a positive 2.7% increase in energy, which is a net increase. When you take that and compare it to oil, where we've talked about a lot today, for every dollar that you put into producing oil, it actually costs you 13 cents to get that same equivalent of energy back, because you have to refine it, you have to drill it, you have to explore it, you have to have fighter pilot escorts of the tankers out of the Middle East. When you take all of that into effect and the amount of energy that it takes, you actually have a loss.
If I may,
go ahead, Robert
Marty.
Bryce.
I mean, this is the thing where the ethanol producers, and the ethanol advocates, they don't study thermodynamics. Look, the idea that that oil takes more energy to produce than it contains, if that were the case, why would we have been using oil and oil almost exclusively for transportation for the last 100 years? If it's a net energy loser, on the face of it, it just is not true. It is flat not true. As for the energy balance of corn ethanol, if you look at studies from the GA, the Government Accountability Office, if you're General Accountability Office, or you look at the Congressional Research Service, independent, right? Not Pimentel, not any of these other people, no other scientists. They say that the net energy gain from corn ethanol is minuscule. 2.7% is tiny. Crude oil conversion into gasoline, for every BTU you put in, you get at least 8 BTUs out. For corn ethanol, one BTU you put in, you get out 1.02. Right? So that's 2% gain. And that is, all, in many cases, then they do, like, you know, math tricks with distillers,
well,
dry grain.
Don't do math tricks on the radio.
That's a minuscule energy gain.
But to you, though, Robert Bryce, if we're talking, though, about a young industry, one that's essentially a startup industry, there still needs to be the infrastructure that needs to be built. Aren't there going to be upfront costs that over time will be reduced?
Well, one would hope, but, you know, we had the computer industry. Did Apple Computer get big federal subsidies to grow the Macintosh? Did Microsoft get big subsidies? I mean, I'd love to be in a business where I could just count on massive federal subsidies in order to grow my business. If ethanol it can work, let it work without big federal subsidies. The fact is, you know, Mr. Soneca talks about, you know, energy and talks about terrorism, all these other things. Is this a jobs program or is it an energy program?
Go ahead, Tom, and then we'll get to our callers.
Well, that's an easy one. The ethanol industry will gladly remove all of its subsidies today if the oil industry removes all of its subsidies today. The oil industry came out a couple months ago and said, we can't afford to build new refineries in this country unless you fund us. And the U.S. government was going to send billions of dollars to help the oil industry build refineries, as if the $47 billion that Exxon makes quarterly isn't enough for them to invest into their own infrastructure. You want to talk subsidies? Yeah. You remove ours, they remove theirs any day of the week. We'll take them on.
And that's Tom Slinica, Executive Director of the Ethanol Promotion and Information Council.
May I make one point just quickly?
Robert, hold on. Let me just reintroduce you, and I do want to give out that phone number. It's okay. A radio show here. We're live. And Robert Bryce, energy journalist, managing editor for the Energy Tribune. Very quickly, and then we'll get to our callers. Go ahead, Robert.
Look, the industry will build refineries when it makes sense to do so. And, you know, if there were big subsidies, I'm sure they would build them faster. But just a few days ago, Motiva Enterprises, which is a joint venture of Saudi Aramco and Shell, again, big oil, nobody likes big oil. Okay, we can bash them if we like. They're going to double the size of their refinery in Port Arthur, Texas. They're going to increase the refinery's output by 325,000 barrels a day to take the refinery to 600,000 barrels a day and make it the biggest single refinery in America. That one refinery will have more motor fuel output, more oil equivalent output. In fact, we'll have three times as much usable motor fuel output as all of the ethanol refineries now operating in America.
Very quickly, Tom, and then we'll get to our callers.
Well, I think that's great. I think I asked, where were they over the last 20 years and not building any refineries while
that's
they watched
not true.
The American population?
They were adding capacity
okay.
to
$4
all the refineries.
A gallon for
okay,
their product for profitability.
I'm going to jump in here because I do want to get some callers in the conversation. And we've got Doris from Valley Center, California. Hi, Doris. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, basically, I'm surprised that, you know, this is a debate. Check European standards. They're looking ahead for us. You know, we spend over $3.25 for a gallon of gas, and every week it keeps going up and down. We can't afford this. We need to look at other alternatives. And to support oil, it's not an unlimited resource. Why are you guys arguing? You need to be looking ahead and taking the consumer into consideration.
And by consumer into consideration, Doris, I mean, what? Speaking for all consumers, what do consumers want?
We need to see some progress. We need to see people coming together. When I go to Europe, I see biodiesel fuel. I see people using renewable resources. You know, they're looking at automobiles that get better gas mileage, and all we do is fight back and forth and point fingers on who's trying to do what and what. You know, it makes us feel as if we are totally out of control and that there's no one that is actually supporting us and our children and our grandchildren so that there's, you know, an environment that we can live in.
Well, Doris,
actually drive around in.
Well, fair enough. And, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Tom Slinica a chance to respond to that.
I'm applauding. I absolutely agree. The ethanol industry is trying to bring you an alternative. Right now, we're getting bashed every time we look. There's a definite undertone that's being led by someone. Because you know, 2 years ago, everybody says yes. Let's see what we can do with this product. Now there's been a slowing because we're starting to take some of that precious market share away from crude oil. Look, I've got three young kids, and I want to make sure that they've got an alternative as well. That's exactly what we're trying to do.
And to you, Robert Bryce?
Well, yes, I'm all for alternatives. I have the 3,200 watts of solar panels on my house. I think that renewable energy is fine, and biofuels, that they, you know, they certainly have applications in niche markets. But what we have seen is mandates for ethanol production. The Senate bill, the Senate energy bill, had a mandate for the production of more than 30 billion gallons of ethanol. You know, I'm all for alternatives. I just want to make sure that the price remains appropriate and as low as possible. Ethanol has always cost more than gasoline on a BTU equivalent basis. And second, you know, consumers, they complain about the price of gasoline. The fact is, and these are facts from the Energy Information Administration, gasoline today is cheaper than it was on an inflation-adjusted basis than it was in 1919. People complain about paying $3 a gallon for gasoline. A gallon of, and yet they go to Starbucks and plop down the equivalent of about $23 per gallon for a venti latte, or $11 for a gallon of Budweiser. The fact is, gasoline is cheap. You know, quit complaining.
Let me get John from Berks County to join us. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Hi. Hi there. Yeah, I'm a farmer out here, actually. And can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead, John.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
And, you know, I mean, the one thing, I had two comments. One is that, you know, the price for feed has really been affected, you know, as, you know, corn is getting more and more expensive. And that's, you know, affecting dairy prices and meat prices. And the other thing is, No, I think they sort of jumped the gun here. You know, the using the cellulosic process, you know, is a great idea. That's using cropland that can't really be used for anything else. And instead we're using corn, and I think we're also, you know, refusing to import from Brazil, who's already set up to do it.
Those are all really good points, John. I want to give our guests a chance to respond to them. Thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Okay, I'm going to get off.
Okay,
on the tractor.
Get back to your tractor and your cows, I'm assuming. Tom Slunica, and I read about this in preparation for the show, which is that the farmers who need corn to feed their cows are finding those prices are going up because more and more corn is being diverted to ethanol.
Yeah, you know, corn is nowhere near a record high today, and we've not even produced as many acres of it as we have in the past. We certainly, in agriculture, we certainly are going through a change in our economies and how we feed our cattle. And actually, as a farm kid myself, I certainly understand what he's saying. In the past, we would store our corn on farm, we'd grind it and feed it to our cattle whenever we needed it. In Europe, for the last 50 years or so, they've had a system much similar to where ours may evolve into, which is a more central located storage facility that we're actually getting these distillers' grains to feed to our livestock and our dairy cattle. And on a pound per pound basis, the grains that are left over from the ethanol process have 2x the feed value that raw corn did, because we have taken a lot of the things out of that kernel that the cow didn't use. And so we're going through some changes. We're going through some growing pains along those lines. Now, to his comment about Brazilian ethanol, we are not blocking Brazilian ethanol coming into this country. What we are doing is that we have an import tariff that's in place. Of course, it's in place for many, many feed goods. But when you take that and you alter it with the 51-cent tax blender's credit, it actually allows them to bring that product in for the exact same price that a U.S. ethanol producer can bring the product into this country. So we are not blocking that. We just want to make sure that it's fair from a trade perspective.
And let me get Robert Bryce, you to respond to that. And there is, as we know, Brazil very much using ethanol for their cars and for energy there.
Sure. Brazil is an important story.
Yes,
and it's
it
one
is.
That, you know, let me just address the you know, Mr. Slenica calls it the import tariff. It's protectionism. That's just, you know, it's, again, subsidies, protectionism. They want to protect the domestic ethanol business, and that's what they're doing. Brazil, in 2006, the U.S., everyone talks about ethanol in Brazil. That's fine. The U.S. actually produces more ethanol than Brazil. That's point one. Second, the Brazilians are far more efficient ethanol producers than the U.S. because they use sugar cane. They can use sugar cane because they have ultra-cheap labor, some of which, in fact, is in fact, slave labor. And there have been numerous stories about the problems with slave labor in the sugar cane industry in Brazil. But the most important fact here is that while everyone talks about ethanol in Brazil, they forget about the tremendous success of Petrobras, the Brazilian national oil company. In 2006, the U.S. imported 11 times as much energy from Brazil in the form of crude oil and refined products as it did in the form of ethanol. The fact that, you know, we could import all of Brazil's ethanol, all of it, all 5 billion gallons a year, it would still only equal 1% of America's total oil needs. So, you know, Brazil's a good story, but it's specific to Brazil. It has nothing to do with the situation in America, because they only have one-tenth as many automobiles in Brazil.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take another short break, get back to our guests and to our callers. That's Robert Bryce. He's an energy journalist, managing editor for the Energy Tribune. Also with us, Tom Slunica, executive director of the Ethanol Promotion and Information Council. Yes, we are talking about ethanol, and we've got a full bank of calls. We will get to our callers after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY and presents choreographer Paul Taylor's Company B, set to the Andrews Sisters hits at the Merriam Theater October 10th to 14th. Also in this program is George Balanchine's Concerto Barocco and Matthew Neenan's As It's Going. Pennsylvania Ballet performs Company B at the Merriam. For tickets, 215-336-2000 or www.paballet.org.
On October 25th, WHYY's The Next Mayor Project hosts a candidate forum. It's your chance to pose questions to the hopefuls, but we'd like you to do it in video form. Email your video or a clever computer-generated character asking about your most important issue. Be creative and make it personal. Then log on to the forum on October 25th as we put those questions to the candidates. For more details, visit whyy.org.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener has graduate programs in education, social work, business, engineering, and more. Widener is hosting a graduate open house on Thursday, October 18th on the main campus in Chester. To register, 1-888-WIDENER or widener.edu. Other programs available in social work, physical therapy, criminal justice, and public administration. 1-888-WIDENER or online at widener.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The U.S. consumes about 21 million barrels of oil a day. About 12 million of those barrels come from foreign countries. President Bush, Congress, Al Gore, and others have said they want to increase the amount of ethanol that's produced domestically to make the country more energy independent and to reduce the harmful byproducts of fossil fuels. But would increasing the amount of ethanol have the desired environmental and economic effects? We've got two perspectives, one from Robert Bryce, and he's managing editor for the Energy Tribune, and Tom Slunica, executive director of the Ethanol Promotion and Information Council. Let me get back to our callers, and we've got Chad from Allentown joining us. Hi, Chad. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The first thing I'd like to say, Marty, is that the ethanol advocate, although he may work for a nonprofit himself, represents people that stand to profit greatly the more and more money we put into ethanol.
He represents people in the ethanol industry, so there's no mystery about that.
As a nonprofit, his interests are to make profit, are to eventually gain profit for the people that, you know, sponsor he represents.
Well, hold on to that thought, and let me give Tom just a chance to respond to that comment. Then we'll hear your question. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, certainly, we're not hiding the fact that this is a not for profit, but it is a trade organization. Now, that means that we have to abide by certain governmental rules and so forth. But if not us, who? I mean, every industry has their organizations that understand the information and have access to the greatest amount of information or at least utilize it on a day-to-day basis. And that's really what I'm here to help provide is that other voice.
Forget that perspective. And your question, Chad?
Well, the reason I ask is that it seems the yield for corn is just so unbelievably low that there has to be some sort of ulterior motive. Could you explain to me the yield difference between sugar cane ethanol and corn-based ethanol, please?
Yes. It's just a factor of where these crops are. Because ethanol is a starch-based product, we have to first release the sugar from the starches, and then from there, we ferment the product just like the sugarcane industry does. It's just the dynamics of our environment here in North America. Starch-based crops grow further north than do sugar-based crops, with the exception of sugar beets up in North Dakota and Minnesota, but that's a very small area in which that they'll thrive. So our process has to have more expense because we have to break it loose from that starch. Now, the same will be true of cellulose. The backside of the process for cellulose production for ethanol is the same as it is for sugarcane. But first, we have to break it loose from the lignin and the cellulose and the hemicellulose materials of that plant, whether it be a tree or a grass. So that does add cost to the production cost.
And where do you stand, Robert Bryce, on cellulosic ethanol?
Well, cellulosic ethanol is like the tooth fairy. A lot of people believe in it, but no one ever sees it. The idea that, you know, a scientist and a chemist in the University of Denver put it to me the best way. He said, look, humans have been making booze, alcohol, for 5,000 or 6,000 years. Now, today, we make it out of corn, we make it out of rye, we make it out of wheat, potatoes, grapes, you name it. You know, cherries, apples, you can ferment a whole range of things and make some form of alcohol from it. He says, don't you think if there was a way, a good way to make it out of grass or sawdust or wood chips or something, we would have done it by now. And I think that's the exact point. The idea that somehow we're going to be able to use cellulosic ethanol and produce huge amounts of motor fuel from, you know, grass or whatever, is it's fine. It's a nice idea. It's a good dream, but we've been talking about it now for 20 years, and there is no commercial production of cellulosic ethanol. My bottom line is I want... You know, I want to keep the air conditioners running and the beer cold, and whatever, and if that takes using fossil fuels, you know, that's what I'm for. And I'm for renewables as well, but we have to be sane about how we approach it.
But I mean, you could say, you could look at science, you could look at medicine. I mean, you know, we didn't have antibiotics 100 years ago, and now we have them today because there was investment, there was research. Why not use that same kind of ingenuity and energy and look at the possibilities in cellulosic ethanol?
I'm not opposed to looking at the possibilities, but again, the cellulosic ethanol sector is getting, you know, this year alone, I think, some $300 or $400 million in federal grants. That's fine, but the fact is that, you know, plants have built up resistance to outside invaders, whether it's pests or the wind or whatever, in order to have strong plant walls. And that's enough. That is the key issue. How do you break down that cellulose and make a simple sugar out of it? It is very, very difficult. And this is something that, yeah, it's going to take a lot of research. But remember, even if we had some tremendous breakthrough today in cellulosic ethanol, it took 2.5 decades with huge federal subsidies for the corn ethanol industry to get where they are today at 5 billion gallons per year, of, or 1% of America's oil needs.
Marty. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, look. If I take your premise, then I would say we might as well just live with breast cancer. We might as well just, you know, it's here
that's
today.
That's not what I said.
We haven't conquered it yet, so you know, let's just live with it. You know, that's ridiculous. Look, the ethanol industry has, in the last 3 years, went from, like I said, 2.5 gallons per bushel to 3 gallons per bushel. That is a huge increase, and I'm here to tell you that there actually is an active cellulose production facility today that's actually working. So, you know, yes, the ethanol industry took 20 years to get to where it is today, but look at the production that has came on in the last 18 months. We have doubled in the last 18 months. So don't say that we can't ramp it up quickly. You know, the American entrepreneur, the American investor has the ability to quadruple the amount of ethanol production from an investment standpoint nearly within just a few months. And cellulose, now that it is commercially produced, it'll have the same opportunity as long as we don't have folks that are completely throwing us under the bus before we have the opportunity to prove what we can do.
Let me get back to our callers, and we've got Dave from Reading joining us. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. I was just had a question for the person who is in favor of the ethanol.
Uh-huh. Tom Slunica?
Yeah. How are you doing today?
Go ahead, Dave.
The question was, is I was reading on a few journals that the hemp plant, the cannabis plant, in the industrial setting has no drug addictive properties or THC, but can be turned into 100% yield of ethanol. And it's also a renewable crop that can be grown and harvested 4 times per year, as opposed to corn, which only gives you about a 30% yield and can only be grown once per season. How come we haven't been looking into that as an alternative means of a clean, renewable energy that doesn't need pesticides? It's pesticide resistant. It can be farmed easily in any temperate climate, and we're not using that. Why not? Well, that seems like the most feasible alternative to me.
Let me find out what. And thanks, Dave, for the call. Tom Slunica, have you looked at hemp as a part of the cellulosic ethanol possibility?
Well, actually, in the research, they are looking at all forms of cellulose production. Switchgrass is the one that people have talked a lot about. There are fast growing poplar trees. There are just a numerous amount of products, and once we've perfected the enzyme combination that will utilize or that will break down the sugars in the cellulose product, I think that hemp could be an opportunity. We just don't know yet. But first we have to perfect how we break it down, and then we can look at the various feedstocks to see which is the most efficient.
And Robert Bryce, you have a position on hemp?
Oh, well, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense if we can, you know, again, it could work in a niche application, but remember the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency has prevented even, I think it's in North Dakota, the farmers there have applied repeatedly to be granted licenses to grow it, and the feds have repeatedly denied it.
But does it make sense to think niche-wise when we're thinking about our energy needs in the future, Robert Bryce?
Well, of course. And I criticize ethanol. I'm not saying all ethanol is bad or that we shouldn't be producing some ethanol. The fact is we have to be guardians. We have to be fiscally conservative in how we manage this. Yes, ethanol can have some application. Hybrid electric vehicles can contribute here. So can, you know, all electric vehicles. That's some, that, you know, every little bit is going to make some difference. Increases in efficiency will make some difference. But remember, the national there were a study put out a few years ago by the National Energy Policy Council, I think it was, said even if we double CAFE standards today, that by 2020, oil consumption in America will still increase by 3.3 million barrels per day. So efficiency is good, niche applications are good, but the fact is, like it or not, we depend on fossil fuels, and we're going to depend on fossil fuels for a long time.
Well, until they run out, and then what?
Well, and corn will, there's not an unlimited amount of corn either. And, you know, remember, people have been forecasting that we're going to run out of oil ever since oil was discovered. I'm not saying that it's an infinite amount either. But I think that people forget about, you know, what new technologies can be brought to bear. We're now turning, in the Persian Gulf, there's turning natural gas into motor fuel in an economic and efficient way. There are a lot of solutions as the price rises to find new oil. Look at the Jack discovery in the Gulf of Mexico last year. They found what could be deposits of 15 billion barrels. That's a lot.
Let me get back to our callers. We've got Dave from West Conshohocken joining us. Hi, Dave. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi there. A recent National Geographic study or article, they showed that all the different biofuels and how they produce different amounts. But one of the things they also showed was their carbon emissions. And the savings on the or the reduction in carbon emissions for any of the biofuels is really nominal as compared to oil. So we're not addressing that at all with biofuels.
Yeah, and I'd like to have you. I'm actually looking at that National Geographic, Tom, as our caller is talking. And this
thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
No,
thanks.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Bye. Tom, you want to speak to that?
Well, certainly there are a lot of different studies that are out on CO2. Obviously, we have met all of the criteria. I mean, numerous government studies, both not here in the United States, but in Europe and Japan, have concluded that biofuels do reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Bryce will drag up one or two that say that that's not true. But obviously, I'm going to leave it in the hands of our government, not only our government, but other governments that have done the testing extensively and found that we have a reduction. Now, how much is enough? If we reduce today by, let's just say, 2%, is not 2% better than status quo? And where we stand today, is that where we'll be tomorrow? And we've proven repeatedly within this industry that we are living in an age of applied science. The modeling is changing dramatically every single day, and so there'll be increases in the reduction as well.
And I'm looking at greenhouse gas emissions, and this is for corn ethanol when compared to gasoline, which is 20.4 pounds per gallon. Ethanol is 16.2, 22% less, and it comes from a whole variety of sources: the U.S. Department of Energy, World Watch Institute. Do those numbers square with your numbers, Robert Bryce?
Well, there was a study that just came out recently. It was in the Times of London. One of the authors was a Nobel Prize-winning scientist who they looked at the entire life cycle of ethanol production and biofuels production and found one of the overlooked aspects of this was the amount of fertilizer that was put in and the amount of carbon that is released from the farmland initially. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the GAO has put out studies saying the greenhouse gas emissions reductions are nominal. You know, I think it's ultimately about a wash. But again, because biofuels will only be able to, you know, be a niche application, yes, a small reduction is good, but, this isn't going to cure the issue of CO2.
Let me get to Michael from Conshohocken to join us. Hi, am I right? Yes, Michael from Conshohocken. Go ahead, Michael, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I realize your time is short. I basically just want to say a pox on both of these guys' houses. I mean, the corn ethanol is not anything like a meaningful solution or even a meaningful contributor to our problem with fossil fuels, whether you look at it from a greenhouse gas perspective, an air quality perspective, or a perspective of reducing our dependence on a limited resource. It's just a way for governments to pump subsidy money into politically vulnerable areas in the Midwest. On the other hand, the gentleman at the other side of the table is quite rightly pointing a lot of this stuff out, but just promoting essentially status quo and, you know, try to go into ANWR. What we need is real alternatives, real renewable energy, wind, solar, and pumping those energy sources into the grid and putting into plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, which even using existing energy mix we have right now can dramatically reduce CO2 emissions and use of gasoline from foreign sources, and with further developments with renewables for that electricity can keep ramping it down into the indefinite future.
Well, and Michael, you're right. We're almost out of time, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give both of our guests just 30 seconds to respond. Robert Bryce, go ahead. He's saying a pox on both your houses.
Well, okay. I don't think it's true that I'm saying status quo. Yes, the fact is, in terms of status quo, yes, we're going to rely on fossil fuels for a long time to come. I'm all for wind and solar, but like ethanol, they are going to be niche applications for the foreseeable future. Those aren't my projections. That's the Energy Information Administration. I want to separate the rhetoric from the reality, and the reality is my fossil fuels predominate for a lot of good reasons, and that's going to be true for a long time to come.
Go ahead, Tom Sunica.
Well, and we are for change. Now, we know that fossil fuels are here, or better yet, liquid fuels are here for a very, very long time. And if ethanol production only contributes to what Mr. Bryce says is our continuing addiction to liquid fuels or petroleum, then we have given this country something else. Because where is that additional 2% going to come from? We have to have something. We have to try something else. And the government has spent and wasted a lot of dollars on things that haven't benefited anybody. Let's give this renewable fuels thing a chance.
And Tom Sunica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Robert Bryce, thanks for joining us as
well. Thank you, Marty.
And Tom Sunica, Executive Director of the Ethanol Promotion and Information Council. Robert Bryce, Managing Editor for the Energy Tribune. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and find out more about the program. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.